TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Ward Churchill on the History of the FBI. On the 26th anniversary of the firefight on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, the Native American professor, activist, and author, Ward Churchill, spoke in honor of Leonard Peltier. Peltier was sentenced for the murder of two FBI agents, a murder he and others say he did not commit. Even Peltier's prosecutor agrees. 8 years after the trial, Lynn Crooks said, "We really have no idea who shot the agents." Still, Leonard Peltier remains imprisoned today. And you are about to hear a well-researched analysis of the forces that keep him imprisoned. Foremost among them are the FBI and the counterintelligence programs developed by the agency almost from its inception in the early 1900s. Ward Churchill sketches in this talk FBI intervention into the IWW, the Molly Maguires, anarchists, the Communist Party, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Panthers, and many other organizations. Finally, in the 1970s, the full force of the FBI COINTELPRO experience was used against the American Indian movement as well. The conflict at Pine Ridge came about because the federal government had arranged for the transfer of 1/8 of the reservation land to federal ownership. They had discovered uranium and molybdenum on the Sheep Mountain Gunnery Range. When traditional elders resisted the violation of their treaty rights, the Bureau of Indian Affairs gave tribal president Dick Wilson money to create a tribal ranger group, the Goons, in return for his approval of the land transfer. By the time that the American Indian movement, among them Leonard Peltier, arrived at Pine Ridge, upon request of the traditional elders, 69 tribal members had been killed by the Dick Wilson goons, among them women and even children. The FBI had refused to investigate any of these murders, so a small group of AIM members came to the aid of the treaty rights movement. You will hear in a moment in more detail what happened on Pine Ridge. Here are just a few more words on the speaker. Ward Churchill is professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's also a Vietnam veteran and survivor of the 1970s American Indian Movement. His many highly acclaimed books include The COINTELPRO Papers, Indians Are Us, and A Little Matter of Genocide. This is the first of a two-part history of the FBI that goes far beyond the events on Pine Ridge 26 years ago. Here is Ward Churchill.
CO, Osiju. Hello, my relatives. It's good to see you here. My name, as I was introduced, my colonial name is Ward Churchill. I bring you greetings from the elders of the Lynx Clan, of the Katua Band of Cherokee, my mother's people, the elders of the Colorado chapter of the American Indian Movement, of which I'm a part, and from Gwarthy Las, otherwise known as Leonard Peltier, who tonight, as I speak to you, and as I assume all of you know, continues to sit in a cage at the federal prison, Leavenworth, Kansas, not for anything anyone, including his prosecutor, at any point in the past 15 years has been prepared to say they actually believe he did, but rather as a symbol of the arbitrary ability of the federal government of the United States to repress the legitimate aspirations of indigenous people within its claimed boundaries to liberation. This is the anniversary of the firefight that occurred at Oglala Village on the Pine Ridge Reservation, 1975, which, according to the official histories, two FBI agents were murdered by Leonard Peltier. They convened an investigation, unprecedented in its intensity in the history of the FBI, to investigate what they called the reservation murders, and that meant the two agents. Nobody ever investigated the death of Joe Stuntz, who was buried alongside another casualty of the counterinsurgency war that was conducted against the American Indian movement and traditional resistance of the Oglala Lakota on Pine Ridge Reservation during the mid-1970s, Anime Aquash. Both are buried on the Jumping Bull property where the firefight occurred. So before going further, I'd like to ask for a moment of silence in respect and memory of those two fatalities and the well over 60 other American Indian people who died during the course of that counterinsurgency campaign in a three-year period, 1973-76. We have to remember those who have struggled and sacrificed. We have to remember where it is we've come from in order to understand where it is that we find ourselves, where it is that we are. And only in understanding where we are can we plot a course to a better future for our coming generations. These things are connected, and it's that understanding that motivated Leonard, it's motivated others, and has to do with the formation of his case. Because Leonard Peltier is not simply a political prisoner, although he is that. Leonard is a prisoner of war. He is a prisoner of the longest ongoing war in this hemisphere, having at this point lasted a little over 500 years. That's 500 years of conquest, colonization, and genocide. It's also 500 years of consistent resistance on the part of those who were targeted for that. American Indians hold treaty relations with the federal government of the United States, 400 of them duly ratified by the Senate under the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, as well as under international law, as is reflected in the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. Treaty relations are compacts entered into only by co-equal sovereigns, that is, by fully sovereign nations. Every time the United States ratified a treaty with an American Indian people, it provided a formal recognition that the other party or parties to the treaty was a nation in its own right on an equal standing entitled to the same rights as the federal government of the United States itself. So you have this recognition that there are nations other than the United States within the U.S. portion of the North American continent, all of which are subordinated directly to the presumed authority of the federal government of the United States for purposes of extracting their assets, their wealth, for the benefit of the dominant society to the detriment of the indigenous owners. And you have the catastrophic kinds of consequences to the people, to the population, that accrue from all such relationships. That's the nature of the set of circumstances that was confronted by the American Indian movement in the early 1970s, the most forcefully on the Pine Ridge Reservation, because what it was that was being done was the assertion of the rights to sovereign control over lands, lives, and destiny that is inherent to the treated status of American Indian people and is inherent to the fundamental human rights of any people under extant international law. It's the assertion of those rights which precipitated the counterinsurgency war, which brought the repression down. And that takes us to the FBI and the function of the FBI, which, as any of you who grew up watching Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. be Inspector whatever his name was on the FBI on TV, you understand to be the preeminent law enforcement agency, the federal law enforcement agency in the United States, the preeminent investigative agency, having to do with the rule of law, catching criminals, amassing evidence, providing it to prosecutors, furthering the due process and prosecution of those who are guilty of violations and seeing to it that they get their just deserts, that they serve prison sentences or whatever. That's the myth. And the myth predates the FBI TV series. It runs back virtually to the inception of the Bureau. Ultimately, it was an entity created right from the get-go to take the order of business as it encountered, business as usual, and preserve it. That the status quo, the structuration, socially, economically, and politically in the United States is such that there is a place assigned to everyone, at least by virtue of their membership in some rather arbitrarily defined groups. Groups like, oh, I don't know, blacks, Asians, South European immigrants, women, homosexuals, American Indians, Appalachian miners, and other poor whites. Name a group, there's a place. And the function of the Bureau is to make sure you stay in your place. And for people whose place is relatively privileged, that's a good thing. People who are not privileged in this social structuration tend to attempt to change the social structure and circumstance to better their lot. And that's what the FBI was created and developed and perfected to prevent. Now, remember, as we go through this, that the place assigned to American Indians is to serve as resource colonies internal to the United States so that there can be extraction of strategic and commercially valuable minerals and other things fueling the American economy while American Indians starve to death or freeze to death in the localities which they were consigned during the formation of the reservation period. And that's what it was, the American Indian movement, Leonard Peltier, the resistors on Pine Ridge, and others elsewhere were bent upon changing. When did this begin? Because you're always hearing, you know, there's some really nasty stuff going on. I mean, look at the Rodney King case. After all, there's this other case down there in New Orleans where the police were running this racketeering enterprise, shaking down and sometimes murdering tourists and drug dealers as well. And then there's this falsification of evidence in order to take drug dealers out of the community in Philadelphia while the police take over their drug distribution networks. And then there's the LAPD, and then there's the Chicago PD. And, you know, if things keep going on this way, we're going to end up in a police state. Well, maybe we want to interrogate this beast a little more to find out if we really have a need to be concerned that we're going to end up in a police state, as opposed to maybe at some point, and the question would be when, already got there. Instead of trying to prevent something, we need to be figuring out how to undo something, and it's a radically different project between those two things. Bureau started in 1913. It really gets on the map with what are called the slacker raids, and that was using the American Protective League, coordinating its activities to run around and grab young men off the street, several thousand of them in one afternoon, to demand to know why they weren't in military uniform, and demand proof that they had registered with Selective Service for the draft, and so forth. And that was the warm-up, okay? That was to see if the system worked for what they really had in mind. What they really had in mind was the Palmer Raids that occurred a year later. And the Palmer Raids were a roll-up, lock, stock, and barrel of the anarchist and anarcho-syndicalist movement that was quite pronounced in the United States at that time. You had approximately 15,000 people arrested overnight, all of them arrested on the basis of nothing other than that they were recent immigrants to the United States. They were held until they could be sifted out. What they were sifting them for was to find out if they had any sort of an affiliation to a radical organization in their old country, if they subscribed to an anarchist magazine, and so forth. And those that were found to have these kinds of alignments were considered undesirable on the face of it, no hearing required. They were all put on a boat and transshipped, not to the countries of their origin, but to Russia. Now, there were a few Russians on that, but you're talking Southern Italians, you're talking East Europeans of non-Russian origin, you're talking Greeks, you're talking a few Germans. All of them go to Russia because by 1919, you've already had the Bolshevik Revolution, and we'll need to keep all these people in one place. This is a totally arbitrary, and obviously a political maneuver. Theoretically, the FBI did not engage in much political activity thereafter for a period of almost 20 years. Theoretically, that's the way the standard histories read, but the standard histories don't read as consequential movements of, say, African-American people, because during the 1920s, the FBI's main focus was on something called the United Negro Improvement Association, and its leader, a Jamaica immigrant by the name of Marcus Garvey. And UNIA, well, had some things in common with the Black Panther Party, had some things in common with the Nation of Islam, had some things in common with several other organizations, but aside from having things in common with them, it had its own blend and happens to have been, to this day, the largest mass organization of black people in the United States history. ever. And Garvey was targeted for a technical stock manipulation, sent to maximum security prison in Atlanta, Georgia, and ultimately deported back to Jamaica, ended up in Africa, broke the back of UNIA, the organization came apart, and that was exactly what Hoover wanted, and had been wanting for a long period of time. 1918, there's a very interesting memo that's reproduced in one of the books that's available over here, COINTELPRO Papers. This is on first investigation by this young file clerk come anti-radical bureau head named J. Edgar Hoover, when he says, "We've conducted an investigation of Mr. Garvey and his activities, and unfortunately, we couldn't find that he's in violation of any law." So you expect him to go on to say, "We're going to wrap up the investigation." However, that's his word, not mine. However, if we continue the investigation, undoubtedly we'll eventually find something. And eventually, being 7 years later, they did find that technicality. That was a political targeting. The argument will be made when you bring that up, and a lot of other instances as well, that, well, Garvey did violate the law. So you may not like the severity of the dispensation of punishment, but by God, he violated the law, so he got what was coming to him. Well, there's a little principle, constitutionally speaking, in the United States that has to do with equity before the law. And yeah, on some peripheral technical charge, Marcus Garvey undoubtedly did engage in what would be stock fraud. Not that he pocketed any of the money. He simply spent the money on a business other than he offered the stock for, made the investment there. The stock offering was made for a company that was solvent. He put the money into an insolvent company. Okay? That's the nature of the offense. He went to prison for it. On the other hand, you got this other guy whose name may resonate. It was Joe Kennedy. Anybody ever heard of Joe Kennedy, father of a late president? Yeah, Joe Kennedy, whose manipulations of the stock market based on money that he had made being in consort with Meyer Lansky and other bootleggers in New York City led in large part, or significant part, or at least tangible part, to the collapse of the stock market in 1929. Now you're talking about engagement in fraud big time. And what was it they did to Joe? Well, they hired him in the Treasury Department to write laws to prevent people from doing what it was that he did, let him keep the money, and as a reward, when he was done drafting the legislation, made him the first Irish ambassador to the court of St. James. A little different from the punishment meted out to Marcus Garvey, wouldn't you say? The difference being, maybe a matter of complexion. You see, J. Edgar Hoover, aside from disliking radicals with a certain unadulterated intensity, had this little thing about skin tone and other physical characteristics that did not match his own, which is why he referred to Martin Luther King, for example, with a genteel nickname of the Burrhead. You can kind of get an idea of the mentality of the individual out of the language used. This, of course, is in private conversation. This was not for public consumption, but this is the guy who was dictating policy. The IWW trial was the largest mass trial in the history of the United States. 101 defendants, 101 convictions. Everybody who went to trial was convicted. Those who did not evade U.S. jurisdiction went to prison for it. What was it that they went to prison for? Sedition. And what was the sedition? Telling draft-age men in the United States not to go to World War I. That's it. A land of free speech. Wasn't just the IWW, socialist movement as well. You got a socialist feminist from the Midwest by the name of Kate Richards O'Hare, who got a 5-year sentence for informing the women in an assembled audience at the University of Kansas that she considered them to be something more and have a fate more dignified than to serve as brood sows for the enrichment of war profiteers in service to the government of the United States. And I think that's a direct quote. That's what she said, and that was a 5-year sentence. So that's something else we're living with today. You got a guy down here in San Jose, I think, who is going to trial on a hate crime for taking a sledgehammer and going up against a Columbus statue sometime in the recent past. Is that not true? Yeah. Yeah. You got a statue down there to a perpetrator of genocide, a Heinrich Himmler of the Americas. Somebody says that's inappropriate, take it down. They don't. takes direct action against it, and that becomes a hate crime. Well, interesting. If you start putting up statues of Hitler, understand you can't touch that because, after all, to do so would be manifesting, apparently, hate to Germans. No, it's hate to genocide. There's a difference, but not in U.S. jurisprudence. So they take these things and turn them around on political bases. Anybody that thinks you're going to get more laws passed in order to alleviate conditions, understand that every time you get a law passed by this government, this state, you feed into it, you validate it, and they end up using that thing against you. Every single time. It's not to get more laws passed, it's to get the law off our backs. That's another way of saying it's not to reinforce the state structure. The state is not your friend. The point is to get the state off your back. But you got a second Red Scare that's often erroneously referred to as McCarthyism. And McCarthyism literally abolishes the left for a second time in the United States. You don't have to worry about anarchists anymore. They never, ever really recovered from what was done in 1919. I know you got a resurgence of anarchist thinking and anarchist sentiment in the last 10 years in the United States, but there is nothing on the scene right now resembling what it was prior to World War I in the United States. If we got another 20 years of the kinds of growth of anarchist thought and sensibility in the United States that has been evident over the last 10 years, that is an entire generation worth, we might get back somewhere approximately the same point we're a century before. So it had this kind of impact. The IWW had 1 million members. And the things I'm talking about, you need to take a look at and compute in a certain way. And the way you need to compute them is that if the things I'm talking about hadn't been done, what would the face of this society look like now? How would the history of the United States have developed? If an anarcho-syndicalist movement with a highly developed political consciousness and an agenda and effective tactics not been obliterated by the mass trial of its leadership in 1919, but it ultimately evolved and grown according to its own dynamics and its own ability to articulate its message to the public at large, what would the nature of the U.S. labor movement have looked like? What would the work relations in American workplaces look like? How would it be different from the way it is now? I think you can probably connect those dots and trace it out in such a way as to understand things would be very, very different and in a very, very positive form from the way things are now. So these interventions are not simply moral wrongs or matters of historical interest, but things that have direct bearing on the quality of our lives as human beings, interacting with one another, individually and as groups in the United States today. The second Red Square, when they drove left voice entirely out of the academy for virtually a generation, another set of costs and consequences. But in the aftermath of that, is when you see the establishment of this thing called COINTELPRO. And what you have to understand about COINTELPRO is it's not really a disconnect at all from the sorts of things we've been talking about. Everything that becomes an element of COINTELPRO, everything that has to do with its goals and objectives and so forth, was already on the table. They've been doing it to organizations like the IWW and the immigrant anarchists. They've been doing it to the Communist Workers' Party and the Communist Party. They've been doing it to United Negro Improvement Association, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, various elements of the labor movement, Harry Bridges, and so on, all along, but they've been doing that on an individuated basis, on a case-by-case basis. And you had personnel that specialized in it, but they were kind of roving people. COINTELPRO, secret in its inception, made the whole thing centralized, coordinated, systematic, and applicable in a unified fashion at the discretion of the FBI director to any organization, any locality within the reach of the FBI. That hadn't been done before, and it was done in a period of absolute decline of the left. The left was gone. In fact, the FBI had to reinvent the Communist Party. They destroyed it. It was moribund. Such cadre as it had left were all underground and scattered into other countries even. The FBI had to actually reconstitute the CP in order to have a target to use as a laboratory for this coordinated effort. We had this standing joke back in the 60s when I first became active that you could always tell the FBI agent in the Communist Party because that was the only guy in the local chapter that would be paying dues. Okay? Right. But it got a little more than that. You see, some of those chapters were wholly composed of FBI infiltrators. All right? They didn't all know, you know, each of the infiltrators didn't know the other bros were infiltrators, so they were reporting on each other. All right? Sometimes that was a matter of inefficiency, but sometimes it was a matter of, well, we have to have tests and see what the accuracy of the information would be. Now, both parties to this are reporting on one another, and we know what each of them is doing. We can test a relative degree of accuracy of the informant information. See, well, they're doing that in a social science fashion. Yeah. Just bizarre. But some of it isn't funny, because you had still some active cadre who really thought they were communists. And the real communists were getting bad-jacketed by the infiltrators as being infiltrators themselves. Now, you got a couple cases, and I don't recall the names, and that's a disrespect, and I apologize both to the audience for not remembering the names, but more importantly to the people whose names I just forgot. You got a couple of bona fide communist cadres who end up getting bad-jacketed as being infiltrators and go off. I mean, their world's just been destroyed. So they destroy themselves. Got a couple suicides out of this. The FBI chalks these up as successes. By 1960, you got a full-bore counterintelligence program directed at the Puerto Rican independence movement. You got a full-bore counterintelligence program almost simultaneously harnessed to the task of destroying the Socialist Workers' Party. And about 6 months after that, you've got, although they'd never used the COINTELPRO acronym for it, a counterintelligence initiative directed against the civil rights movement in the South, particularly Martin Luther King.
This was the first half of a one-hour history of the FBI with Ward Churchill, recorded on the 26th anniversary of the firefight on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. That took place on June 26, 1975. Ward Churchill is a member of the Keturah Band of Cherokee and professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado, Boulder. His many books include Fantasies of the Master Race, Since Predator Came, and From a Native Son. Next week, you will hear about the collaboration of the FBI with the Ku Klux Klan to suppress the civil rights movement in the South, and the FBI intervention in the internal affairs of the Pine Ridge Reservation. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on this program on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get a copy of the full one-hour history of the FBI with Ward Churchill for $12. That includes shipping. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Glarden. Thank you for listening.